Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening, this is your host, Dan Zupansky, for the program True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. On November 8, 1985, 18-year-old Tom Odell brutally murdered his parents and three siblings in the small southern Illinois town of Mount Vernon, sending shockwaves throughout the nation. It remains one of the most horrific mass murders in U.S. history. Odell was sentenced to death, and after 17 years on death row, expected a lethal injection to end his life. However, Illinois Governor George Ryan's moratorium on the death penalty in 2000 and later commutation of all death sentences in 2003 changed Odell's sentence to life. Prior to the commutation, Odell lived in denial, repressing any feelings about his family and his horrible crime. Following the commutation and the removal of the weight of eventual execution, he was confronted with an unfamiliar reality, a future. As a result, he realized that he needed to understand why he murdered his family. He reached out to Dr. Robert Hanlon, a neuropsychologist who had examined him in the past. Dr. Hanlon engaged Odell in a therapeutic process, which became the basis of their collaboration on this book. Hanlon tells the gripping story of Odell's life, the life experiences that formed his personality, and his tragic homicidal escalation to mass murder. The book that we're featuring this evening is Survive by One, with my special guest, professor and author, Dr. Robert Hanlon. Welcome to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Dr. Robert Hanlon.
Yes, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Very interesting book. Congratulations. Very unique, and let's get right into this. How did you come, I alluded to it in the introduction, but tell us a little bit more about how you came to this project, why you felt compelled to collaborate with this Tom Odell, and why you felt it was important. Obviously, it's a big endeavor to write a book, so tell us how you got to this situation where you felt compelled to Survive by One.
Certainly. Yeah, I first met Tom Odell when he was on death row in the Illinois prison system. He was he had been on death row for, at that point, about 16 years, and he was coming to the end of the appeals process, and he was facing his final execution date. And I was retained by his attorneys at that time to conduct a neuropsychological evaluation of him, kind of as a last-ditch effort to determine if there was really anything that was mitigating any psychological, neuropsychological factors that would be mitigating that his attorneys could, you know, try to use in their appeals. And it turned out I really didn't provide them with anything that was, significant or meaningful with regard to that that strategy. He was actually highly intelligent and really showed no evidence of any kind of cognitive impairments. And what he did demonstrate from the personality testing that I did with him at that time was that, you know, he continued to show some antisocial personality traits and features. And so as a result of that, really my findings were not of much use to his defense attorneys at that time. As it turned out, then the governor of Illinois, due to the fact that there had been distressing and concernful series of exonerations of death row inmates in Illinois over a period of about 10 years, he felt compelled at that time to establish a moratorium on execution. So that basically saved Tom Odell's life. And then over the next 3 years, I had no contact with him. I had, I had basically done my job. I'd conducted my evaluation. And then the governor, in a blanket commutation, commuted all of the death sentences of 167 death inmates in Illinois at that time, and he was one of them. And it was shortly thereafter then that he, kind of out of the blue, to me anyway, I received a letter from him asking me to provide him with some information, if I would be willing to do that, regarding antisocial personality disorder and some questions that he had regarding why he had committed this crime and what I thought might be some of the factors that led to this, why he became who he was. And I learned subsequently that he had kind of arrived at that this kind of psychological state because of the commutation of his death sentence, and suddenly being faced with the fact that he was going to live, and he was going to potentially live a long life in prison, which he had never anticipated or confronted before. And so I found that to be a rather kind of interesting development for an individual like him, who had lived for many years on death row and kind of basically lived in a state of denial and repression because he was anticipating that he was going to be executed. And in his view, why delve into these kinds of serious and painful issues if they're if they're going to kill me anyway,
right?
And so, he contacted me and with some questions, and I responded, and that evolved then into kind of a series of correspondence by letter, and as you mentioned in the intro, then he was, very interested in exploring and trying to understand, his development and his particularly the aspects of his personality that led him to commit this, incredibly horrific crime.
Right. Now, before we get to that crime, I want to ask, did you, or how much experience and how much research had you done? How familiar were you with mass murder itself, or family mass murder, or familiar side, or whatever, if there's a proper term? Tell us what your previous experience and research was regarding this type of mass murder. I know you're a neuropsychologist, but tell us what your experience was specifically.
Well, I had evaluated many murderers before him. At that point, we really didn't have an ongoing criminal forensic research agenda in my lab at Northwestern University Medical School. We were more focused on issues of other types of brain disorders and brain damage, particularly
right.
Traumatic brain injury. And I had been conducting evaluations of murderers for several years. And but he was actually the first family mass murderer that I had evaluated. I had evaluated a couple of other mass murderers at that time, but they were not, they were not family, as you probably know, and your listeners probably know. They're two fundamental types of mass murder, at least in terms of the classifications that come from the FBI type of classification system. There are family mass murderers, and then there are what are called, for lack of a better term, classic mass murders, which are the kind of mass murders that we all too frequently hear about on the through the media, and that mass murders that occur in schools and shopping centers and workplaces and theaters and places like that, where an individual just to some degree randomly murders multiple people that he has no relationship to. So, I had some experience with individuals of that type, but these are these are very, very different. Even though they both fall within the realm of mass murder, and I guess fundamentally that is because just of the number of victims that are involved that are murdered at a single location at a single point in time, but clearly the motives and the agendas of the offender, of the individual, of the murderer are very different.
What I'm referring to is that, well, I might as well ask, how rare is this familicide, this murder of an entire family, even if we if there's a difference between at the end there's a suicide, but obviously you've researched that and you've included it. How rare is what Tom Odell did?
Family mass murders and familicide as such are not extremely uncommon. And clearly the most common type of family mass murder are the types of mass murders that are typically committed by the father and husband. And for various reasons, the father and husband murders his wife or his partner, and then subsequently murders the children, and then usually commits suicide. That is the typical scenario for family mass murders. What is much, much more rare are cases like this, where one of the children murders both parents and all of the other and all of his or her siblings. These crimes are most commonly, about 90% of these crimes, which are technically referred to as parasitical familicide, and which involves the murder of parents and the rest of the family, they are most commonly, as in this case, committed by the eldest male child. These cases of parasitical familicide are relatively rare, even among family mass murders, because probably between 80% to 90% of family mass murders are committed by the husband or father in the manner that I described a moment ago.
Now, as you begin with your book, I think it's essential, obviously, to really understand. I mean, most books will go back into the background of someone, but you have this incredible access to the killer himself, and like you say, he's very articulate. He's quite intelligent, and he is going through this process that you develop where there's introspection, and as a result, he has to be straightforward and very candid, and that's what he's done. So let's go back to the beginning of Tom Odell's life, and because this is the huge part of this book is the why on earth, and so you've provided every single conceivable detail. So take us back to the very strange family of Tom Odell.
Well, yes, he did have an unusual family. Unfortunately, it's probably not as rare as we might like to think. He grew up in an abusive household. In this case, his mother was the abuser, and she was fairly sadistic. And she's very selective in her abuse. She chose to abuse two out of four of her children, Tom being the firstborn, and then of course the eldest child. He was born when she was a very young woman. This is her first child, and She had been also raised in a very oppressive and very restrictive type of household by her parents, particularly her father, and was restricted from a great deal of social activities, and so she had very limited exposure to parenting styles and techniques, and so you know, she was really kind of, you know, to some degree, kind of shooting in the dark, and with regard to, you know, how she was, you know, how she was going to raise her child. And what she did then was basically kind of followed the similar pattern that her parents did, but she then took it to unfortunately, a very devastating extreme, in which she was she would force social isolation on him, force him to stay in his room, would not allow him to socialize with other children, would not allow the children to come to their house, would not allow him to go to other children's houses, and particularly before he started school, he really had minimal exposure to other children his age. At the same time, she was also also physically abusing him through beatings frequently, and then over time that became combined with a great deal of verbal and mental abuse, very sadistic type of demeaning statements that you know, she wished she'd never been born and wished he would die and wished he had wish he was not in her life, and she regretted ever having him, things like that. So these are the kind of things that that he experienced from a very from very young age, the physical and mental abuse. And you know, unfortunately for a child like that, who particularly is being who is socially isolated, he doesn't, you know, kids like that don't know that that's wrong and that's unusual, and that's not the way that you know, most parents, and or at least many parents, treat their children, and kind of assume that this is the way life is, and this is how families are. And so he didn't really come to realize that there was anything unusual about the way his mother treated him until he started school and started interacting with other children more in, say, in the second, third, fourth grade, and had an opportunity to observe how other parents interacted with their children. So that was really the foundation of his personality development, this type of abuse by her. And at the same time, his father was really several steps removed. His father worked nights, and was very I think probably a very affable, likable man, but he was passive and submissive in his relationship with his wife, and despite the fact that he knew that she was executing this type of abuse on Tom during those early years, essentially did nothing to intervene, and that pattern continued over the next you know, for the rest of their lives, basically, because she then she abused their third child, Sean, and she actually, I think, to some degree, abused him more physically than she had actually even abused Tom. One of the things that she would do is she would chain them to their beds at night, so that she could, you know, she could go out with her friends, or she could go out bowling and go out socializing, because her husband was at work, and she was going to go out in the town, and So she would, she would chain these boys to the bed at night. And the other thing that she would also deprive Sean of food in the house and punish him if he did anything to try to obtain food in the house. And as a result, then, of hunger, he would, steal other kids' lunches at school. And that ultimately is what brought attention to the abuse and led to Sean ultimately being removed from the Ola house by DCFS.
Now, Tom being the older son, like we just alluded to this, or we just mentioned that his younger brother actually got the serious attention of the school because despite Tom's bruises and there was an incident where he seemed to talk about the same sorts of things, or at least the abuse in the family, and either was not believed or the mother came by and refuted the story anyway. So tell us a little bit more about, it seems like an escalation in his mother's behavior, though, more socializing. But, and I'm glad you mentioned the chaining to the bed, because when people talk about verbal abuse and physical abuse, it's good we get the details of this, because this is where I say this is maybe not as uncommon as some people would like to think, but this is quite unusual by most people's standards, isn't it?
This kind of behavior where chaining your child to his bed at night is quite extreme. Some parents will lock children in closets. That's another technique that is similar to chaining to a bed. So you're basically restricting their movement and keeping them forcing them to remain in one location so that you can go the parent can go do something else. So I think the important thing is try to imagine. And I think it's difficult for many of us to try to imagine what that experience must be like with when your mother, your primary female role model, behaves in this way and acts this kind of behavior on you as a young child. How that affects your self-image and your self-concept and your understanding of how what kind of a relationship you have with your parents when a parent does something like this. So it's what happened in Tom's case then is very common in children who sustain this type of abuse, particularly at a very young age, is then they start acting out aggressively at school. It's kind of like there's this need to release this frustration and anger, resentment that is building up against the mother, and it's not safe to release it toward her directly. Because you're going to suffer more abuse if you do. So what happens is then these kids at school, start getting in fights. They start become more aggressive, and that's what happened with Tom. And I'm not trying to propose that this is exclusively and 100% due to the abuse that he sustained. I mean he has a genetic makeup that I think also is contributing to some of his behavior and some of his antisocial tendencies. I think we now know pretty well that approximately 50% of in terms of the factors that contribute to violence, particularly in adolescence and then on into adulthood, about 50% of that comes from your, you know, is biological and comes from your genetic makeup. But the other half is derived from your environmental experiences, your, you know, your family relationships, and, you know, so it's the nature-nurture, you know, conflict, which is always, you know, debatable. But, you know, the science that, at least in this point in time, certainly supports that type of division. So, you know, when you add then the two together, so you've got, you know, somebody who's kind of, you know, he's the biological offspring of a sadistic, emotionally detached mother. And so he is, you know, some of his makeup is derived from that. Then you combine that with all the this kind of abusive experience, and also you know, her as a role model. He's also observing her abusing his brother,
right.
And hearing how, you know, her, you know, how she hates his younger brother. In fact, there's this one just really disturbing incident that occurred where, when she was pregnant with Sean, this actually came out in the trial. The next door neighbor, she stood in the driveway between the two houses of their next door neighbor, and told the you know, the next door neighbor that she hated the fetus that was to be Sean before he was even born, and Tom would hear that.
Mm-hmm. And then he, as a consequence, abused his own brother as well.
He did.
Yeah.
And again, you go back to you know, you've got observational learning here. You're seeing your the primary maternal, you know, the primary female role model in your life, and she abused him. And so we had that, you know, experiential learning. Then he observes her abusing Sean and hears her talking about how much she hates Sean even before he's born, and then continues to make those kinds of statements after he's born. And then forces Tom to basically kind of be the pseudo parent to Sean, because she didn't want to be bothering him very much. So she instilled a great deal of resentment in Tom toward Sean, which is, you know, makes it all the more sad that, particularly for Sean, he was just set up to, you know, I mean, his short life was clearly filled with pain and you know, an extreme lack of love.
This Tom Odell, though, really seems to be like many people. Despite their backgrounds and despite their upbringing, they're determined to try to either reinvent themselves or find other people that seem to understand them. Try to you know, reach for something that comforts them from the in pain that they feel, the loneliness or disassociation that they feel. How does he adapt? And for example, you talk about his sexual relationship. Even, of course, his parents have kept him socially inept. So what happens to him at a young age in terms of sexual relationships? How does he adapt? And talk a little bit about how he adapts, sort of trying to survive despite his background that he now realizes that there's something definitely missing.
Well, as he grew older, he then he did benefit then from the socialization that goes on in the school system, and he did, you know, then have the opportunity to interact with normal kids who are coming from normal families with caring and loving parents, and you know, so he did have the opportunity to observe that. But, you know, along the same lines, you know, as he grew into adolescence, you know, he did you know, engage in you know, a lot of promiscuous sex with you know, with young you know, adolescent girls, and which is a typical part of the the development of involvement into a conduct disorder. That's one of the classic features of that, in addition to some of the, you know, the shoplifting and the burglaring and the drug abuse and all those kinds of behaviors. They're all fairly classic. But I think, you know, I think what you may be asking about, and I think it's probably true that he was seeking some affection and physical contact, through his contact with girls, particularly in junior high school and high school as he grew older, because he didn't he didn't experience that kind of affection in the home. He did experience receive some affection of that, just maternal affection from his grandmothers. So he did have that experience. It just was, always just time limited, and it was, it wasn't as often. He loved going and spending time at his grandparents' house because he felt like they cared for him and they loved him, and he didn't feel that at home.
In his adolescence, though, he was shipped over to his grandmother's a couple times, and both times he kind of disappointed them. So tell us how he sort of responds sometimes to the people that he cares about. And of course, this is the side of the story that people, feel less sympathy for.
Sure. Again, I mean, he has, by the time he's an adolescent, he has evolved into a classic, adolescent with a conduct disorder, and he is manifesting many of the behaviors and tendencies that characterize a conduct disorder at that time. And I was enumerating previously. He is, he's lying. He's deceptive. He is manipulative. He will steal. He's breaking rules and he's violating laws and he is acting out in many ways and he's getting in a lot of fights. And that is just part of the classic course there. And he did, he stole from his grandmother despite the fact that, she was one of the, one of the few people that, I think he did feel love from, but he stole money from her and wrote bad checks on her checking account and got caught doing it. It was primarily doing it to get drugs, and it's just kind of the negative spiral that such individuals end up in, where there's a lot of drug abuse and need money to buy drugs and going to do it get that money and however you can. And in this case it was basically stealing from one of the few people that really cared for him.
So his drug addiction, his antisocial behavior, how does all of this stuff manifest itself in the home itself? I mean, he's never gotten along with the mother, and the father is submissive to the mother, so regardless of the kind of abuse. Let's talk after he is finally, said to his mother, "No more, you won't abuse me anymore." But now is there some defiance? What's the dynamic at home, and what's the situation in the household itself, say, in his teen years or 16 years old or so?
Yeah, in the teen years, you're right. He eventually stood up to her, and I think in one occasion where she was, slapping him, he finally said, "That's it. That's enough." And he pushed her against the wall and held her against the wall and said, "You're not going to, you're not going to hit me, you're not going to beat me anymore. And that essentially was the end of her physical abuse of him. He had, you know, he had established himself as a problem child years before, and he wasn't really, you know, he wasn't developing out of that. In fact, he was, you know, he was getting worse, if anything. Particularly with the drug abuse, Tom Odles is a smart individual. He's intelligent, and he could conceal his behaviors. I mean, most of the drug abuse and most of the drinking was done, you know, outside of the house. He would come home drunk, and he would come home high and intoxicated with various drugs, and sometimes, you know, he'd be confronted with his parents. Other times, he'd just kind of sneak in and, you know, and pass out in his room. So he managed to. And I'm sure at that point, and this is speculative on my part, but I'm sure his parents at some point just would turn their head and didn't want to have to deal with him at times. When he was, when he was drunk or he was high, I think they were well aware of it. The father is working at night. You know, he's working, from say 4 to midnight, so he's not there, in the evening. And the mother, as he grew into adolescence, his mother is she's out with a friend. She's out bowling and out on the town. So it wasn't, he could arrange it so he would, could avoid them.
Now, I'd like to get to this, how we get to the situation. Obviously, there's another part of the story, too. Maybe we'll talk about that, and then we'll get to how the family itself gets to the point where they just can't have him around anymore. So how we... What are the, I guess, chain of events that happen that they just don't want him around anymore? But before that, there is some, looks like something in the wind for him, and he joins the Army. So tell about his experience with the Army.
Well, yeah, the Army was probably, even though it wasn't a matter of choice by him, he basically had... His girlfriend had gotten pregnant, and his girlfriend's father said, you know, look, either you're going to get statutory rape charges against you, or you're going to have to go to the Army. You have to leave town, basically. And so that was kind of the deal that was made, that he would join the Army, and she ended up then having an abortion. And so he went off to the Army, and it is extremely unfortunate that he didn't stick that out, because that was probably the best opportunity that I think Tom Odle ever had. He could have stayed in the Army and worked through that, and then never actually returned to live in the Odle house, and that would have probably prevented this crime from ever happening. But unfortunately, he was still relatively immature at that time, and his girlfriend is still back in back in his hometown and writing letters saying how much she misses him, and the next thing you know, he's he's doing whatever he can to try to get out, and basically uses the fact that he's got a bad knee and saying that he can't do some of the physical exertion that's required in basic training, and the next thing you know, he gets a medical discharge, and so then he's back he's back at home. And so in his mind, to some degree, he'd kind of failed there, and then as soon as he returned to his hometown, he realized that his girlfriend really had moved on, and she had, she wasn't really just waiting for him, and he had really done that for nothing. And at that point, I think it's kind of the beginning of the decline that ultimately resulted in the murders. He made that decision. He went back there, and then he basically rejected. And he then turned to a no-holds-barred type of drug-fueled existence and returned to the property crime and the drug crimes that he had been committing when he was younger. And it was a downhill ride for him emotionally and psychologically. Overall, from that point onward.
Well, what I found was interesting is that, and I'll maybe just talk about this now. We could talk about this a little bit later too, just because I have you here. About trauma itself, what one person might perceive as a traumatic event in their life, when you talked about the story. He left the military because she wanted to tell him something. And apparently he got discharged from the military, the army, which he really enjoyed. And it was something he felt really he belonged to. But yet when he saw her, what she wanted to tell him was that she had been fooling around with somebody he knew and she had moved on. So I thought, if anything's going to, snap this man to a certain degree, he said it felt like he broke his heart. And of course, it led to this decline. But is there any talk or any research about how people perceive what one person might see as a traumatic event, another person might just shrug off that type of event?
Well, I think there is. I think it comes down to individual differences, and that some of us can kind of step back and keep things in perspective and realize that, I kind of got burned with this and this is not what I expected, but, I'm not going to just lose it over this. And, I've got a little more willpower and I've got some ego strength to push me through this, and I'm going to be okay. And it may take me a little while, but, I'm going to recover. That's what many of us do, and we have that resilience. Tom Odell didn't have that resilience, and given his background, I think, and the personality development that he had previous to that, this was another in a long line of failures and rejections. And it was just kind of, I think, almost, to some degree, confirming to him that, I'm worthless, and I'm not. My mother's right. I'm a loser, and so why should I try? And that's really the perspective that he took at that time, and I think that's what he thinks he did at that time. And there was one then, final, attempt that he made to, kind of get away from the family, and he had moved to Kentucky because he knew a guy down there that he had met in the army, and then that kind of fell through, and he felt like he'd been manipulated, and that then just got turned into another personal failure. And in my opinion, he at this point he's becoming progressively more and more clinically depressed, and he's taken a very negativistic outlook. He has a pessimistic view of himself and his future, and he's starting to perceive the world as a threatening place that, where people can't be trusted, and it's kind of him against the world, and that's what I was talking about earlier in terms of this kind of this spiral downward that occurred following his departure from the army.
Now, how long is it from the time he's discharged from the Army and this decline? How long are we talking about in terms of months, approximately?
That's really only about a that's less than a year. So it is it's relatively a rapid period of decline there. Because he had he really to a large degree just gave up, and he was thinking a lot more and more about suicide during that period of time. He would play Russian roulette. He played Russian roulette a few times. I think he kind of scared himself ultimately playing Russian roulette, and then stopped. But he certainly was thinking about suicide, and so he really wasn't thinking about any kind of realistic future. He had by all basically given up. And then as time went on, with his parents perceived as his refusal to attempt to initiate anything productive, an attempt to move on with his life, they then told him that we're done with you. We're going to kick you out of the house. You're going to have to make it on your own. We don't know how you're going to do that. We don't really care how you're going to do that, but we've had it. And they drew the line and they set the date, and that was the eve of the end.
Now, later he talks about especially thinking about certain events on the evening before, and of course he's doing various drugs, PCP being, if not everybody knows about that, quite a powerful drug, LSD, PCP, smoking weed, and drinking alcohol, and probably maybe some pills too, but specifically cocaine and PCP and alcohol and marijuana. Tell us about the night before, on the eve of the fateful day.
Yeah, the night before he was using multiple drugs, and as he did every day, at that point in his life, there was no direction, there was no initiative, there was no plan. It was just living from day to day and hour to hour, and scoring drugs that were available, and with whatever money he could scrape up, and then just doing them immediately. And the night before, he had the idea of killing at least some of the family members. I think primarily the idea at that point was to kill his mother. The impetus behind the Odell family murders was clearly to kill Carolyn Odell, and that was that's very clear, and that was very clear in his mind at the time. But he did have that idea the night before. It wasn't a well planned. He didn't really have a strategy. It was more of a it was an idea that I could just kill her and then kill myself, and that would be, and that'll be the end of it. So there was this brief, really somewhat fleeting premeditation of the murder that he did have the night before.
Now, how did events unfold the next day, start in the morning, if you could, please?
Sure. The next morning, you know, again, as his, you know, the father working at night, so his father's up, his father gets up, you know, a little bit later than the rest of the family. The, you know, his mother had gotten up, the other three kids had gotten up, they'd gone off to school, one was still in elementary school, and one was in junior high school, one was in high school. And so they had gone off to their, you know, they had some breakfast and gone off to school, and Carolyn, the mother, had gone off to run her errands, and, you know, she had to deposit some, you know, money from the bowling league, and then she had to go to the school, because she was, at that time, the parent, she was president of the parent-teacher organization at the elementary school where all the Odell children had attended. And the PTO had their meetings in the school library. So that's what Carolyn was doing that morning. So that left Tom and his father alone in the house. And so his father was you know, sitting in the kitchen, you know, having some coffee and having a little breakfast. And Tom gets up and you know, as usual, smokes a joint or two, and. And then, you know, comes into the kitchen and has some, you know, superficial interaction with his father. And then as he is finishing this brief talk with his father, he looks over and he sees the, you know, a rack of knives on the counter. And I think at that point it just kind of registers with him, and he remembers what he was thinking about the night before, and he takes one of the knives, an old hickory butcher knife, that's the brand, Old Hickory, and kind of, you know, tries to conceal it behind him, and then and hopefully his father doesn't notice it, and then kind of to his surprise, and his father gets up to move or to answer the phone or something, but you know, Tom tries to kind of hide the knife, but doesn't do a very good job of it. And then the next thing, his father turns around, and Tom just pulls out the knife and stabs him in the neck. And you know, and his father, you know, looks at him in shock, and you know, sits back down, you know, backwards into the chair at the kitchen table, and you know, looks at Tom and you know, in disbelief, and tells Tom that he loves him, and Tom at that point thinks to himself, this really, you know, that doesn't make any difference, and stabbed him again, and then his father, due to massive blood loss, because he's had his jugular vein severed, and he's bleeding profusely from his neck, he then slides to the floor and dies on the kitchen floor. And Tom at that point then puts the knife down and drags his father by his feet through the living room, down the hall, and into the master bedroom, and then on into the master bathroom, and places him on the floor in the master bathroom, and goes about cleaning up the drag marks and the blood that's pooling on the kitchen floor. And because he knows that his mother is going to be coming home within an hour, and he wants to be prepared for her arrival.
And what does he do on her arrival?
When Carolyn arrives home, the Odell family would enter the home typically through their back door, which entered into the kitchen. And you know, he heard her. You know, drive in, you know, the gravel driveway, and he positioned himself behind the door, and Carolyn came in and closed the door and turned and saw him there behind the door, and stared at him, and then he very quickly stabbed her two or three times in the neck immediately, and she staggered backwards, managed to stay on her feet, and threw her car keys at him, and screamed at him, are you trying to kill me? And he said, yes, I am. And at that point, then she tried to maintain her balance and tried to escape from him by running into the living room. And he just attacked her while she was trying to escape from him, stabbed her some more. She eventually fell in the hallway, and he then dragged her into the master bedroom, and in a a rather sadistic manner, while she was still conscious, forced her to look at her dead husband lying on the bathroom floor before she died.
Now, this is a little bit after noon. What does he do after he kills his mother? What's the next chain of events?
After he kills his mother, he again has to clean up the blood, and he did so with some cleansers and towels, and then also washed his. He had blood all over his clothes, so he then also washed the clothes that he had been wearing and changed his clothes. His youngest brother, Scott, was still in grade school, and so he would get home earlier than the other two siblings. And so, Tom was there at the house when Scott arrived home. And Scott was probably Tom's favorite. Tom really had no affection for his sister Robin. They really had no connection. In fact, he kind of resented her. She was the second child, and his mother had showed her a lot of attention, and I think he had kind of resented Robin from a very young age because of that. Scott came home, and although Tom had cleaned up a lot of the blood that was there, it's given the amount of blood loss that occurs with these kinds of stab wounds, there was blood spatter on walls and on the TV and on the dining room table. There was there was blood spatter, and Scott could see it, and said, what is this? And Tom just kind of tried to point it off that this was solid. It's just paint. We were painting earlier, and it's probably unlikely that Scott really believed that, but he probably was just confused and trying to figure out what was the situation he was in. And then Tom eventually, Scott's 10 years old at the time, and Tom eventually said, "Oh, why don't you come back to my room? I want to show you something." And so he basically lured Scott back to the to his bedroom, and then when he was there, he then grabbed a pair of pajama bottoms and started strangling Scott, and eventually strangled him to death with the with the pajama bottoms.
Does he bring the his brother's body into the bedroom as well?
Yes, he did. He then, he drug Scott into the parents' bedroom, laid him next to Carolyn, and so he's essentially just kind of lining them up. He's not you know, stacking them. He's laying them next to each other. You know, Robert, the father, is in the master bed bathroom. Carolyn is at the foot of the bed, and then Scott is laid next to his mother, Carolyn, also essentially at the foot of the bed. So at that point, you know, the three family members are, you know, are dead, and you know, actually, it was one thing I didn't mention was kind of that occurred, I think, in the, before Scott had gotten home. Carolyn's best friend, a woman named Yvonne, arrived at the Odell house, and unbeknownst to her, of course, Carolyn and Robert already lay dead inside the home, and she was stopping by to share some news with Carolyn, and Tom basically went out and intercepted her in the driveway to not, you know, so she wouldn't even get anywhere near the house, and lied to her and managed to send her on her way. I think it's probably an experience that that Yvonne looks back at, and I think it's probably an event that has haunted her for probably most of her life, because I'm sure I suspect she believes that if Tom had not realized that she had pulled into the driveway, and if she had gone up to the Odell back door, entered the home, she would have probably been killed.
Right.
So after the killing of Scott, then Tom then went over to he went to pick up his other two siblings. He went to pick up Robin and Sean at school and drive them home. And so he drove his father's car over to their to the school, picked them up, drove them home, and then and surprisingly, they're at least according to Tom, they two of them didn't really notice any blood stains or changes in the house environment. And kind of Robin went on her own way, went into her room and was doing something in her room, and Sean was talking to Tom, and then Tom said got Sean to come into come back into his room, and basically blindfolded Sean, and then as soon as he had blindfolded him, he just started stabbing him repeatedly in the neck and the back, it's the point where I think Tom thought that he had killed Sean, and then kind of closed the door and went to find Robin, and then much to Tom's surprise, heard Sean up and moving in the room. And so Tom then rushed back into that room and then stabbed Sean repeatedly in the face and the neck, and to an extreme degree, and killed him then. And then he went to get Robin, and placed Sean in the room with the rest of the family, and then went to Robin was then alone in her room. She was, I think, in her room watching television, so she was kind of unaware that all this, that this was going on between Sean and Tom in the other room. And he went to Robin, and again in another kind of sadistic manner, told Robin that he had a surprise for her, and that and to come with him, and he walked her down to the parents' bedroom and stood behind her and put his hands over her eyes and said, I've really got a great surprise for you, and then released his hands, and so that she saw her entire family lying dead in pools of blood in the master bedroom, and then Robin started screaming for her life, and then Tom stabbed her to death.
Now there's a little bit of cleanup, but what does Tom Odell do? And in retrospect, when he talks about how was he feeling? What was his state of mind?
At that point, his state of mind was rather numb, and I think somewhat emotionless. He had. I think it's likely that he was kind of at that point in time, kind of in a derealized state where he took some money from his mother's purse. He took some money out of his father's pocket. He laid the knife on the bureau in the room where all the bodies lay. And walked out of the house and got in his father's car, which he had always been prohibited from driving, and went to pick up his friends and his girlfriend at that time, because he had previously made arrangements to spend a night in a local motel with his young girlfriend, and so what they did then was, he picked up his friends. They drove around. They smoked some weed. They got high. He picked up his girlfriend at the Burger King. They drove around some more. And then eventually they went to he then also bought some more weed and bought some PCP. And then they went to a little local mom and pop type of motel in Mount Vernon. And so they went there and checked in and proceeded then to just sit in the motel room, smoke some more weed. And then eventually the other couple, the friends, needed to leave, and Tom drove them home, and left his girlfriend at the motel, dropped the friends off, went back to the hotel, and then went to bed. I don't. According to him, he didn't really sleep at all that night, and. But I think he was still between the drugs that he was doing and I think just the emotional state of this, of the aftermath of what he had done, he still was in somewhat of a derealized state of mind. And I think it really wasn't until the following morning then when his girlfriend called a friend of hers and was informed that it had been announced on the news that the police were looking for Tom Odell because his family had been murdered, that the awareness hit him that what he had done. And he still had a hard time accepting it, I think. And it really actually took him, I think, a few days after he was arrested and in jail to kind of fully understand and accept what he had done. According to him, his plan was that he was going to drop off his girlfriend later that morning, and then he was going to go out and he had planned to kill himself and uh, He really didn't have a really very formulated plan, but most likely, I think he was probably going to he would just probably do a high speed car crash and kill himself, and might very well have done a head on collision and killed yet somebody else.
Now we don't have as much time as I would like with covering this book, but. Let's get to a couple sort of important things and let the audience go out and get the book and read more of the really personal letters that were sent to you describing Tom Odell's entire life. And then, of course, the trial and, of course, what happens with that. And then the death penalty is commuted so that he now has this realization that he really needs to understand how he did this and why he did this and specific reasons. With Tom Odell, in retrospect, after the death penalty is commuted and he's corresponding with you for this project and that's part of his the therapy itself, in your book, when he talks about the actual, it's an interesting how detailed his entire life is, and he, with your aid, is really able to look at certain events and say, yeah, this event where I showed my mother something that everyone was proud of, and I was rejected, or I was an architect and I wanted it, and I was rejected, and this woman and I was rejected, and my father could have stood up for me, but I was rejected and unloved, and so there's all these events. So but when we get to the actual day of the murders and how he could think like that to murder his whole family, it seems that tell us about the. I mean, I think that there's so much detail except for that in terms of why. And I mean, I think that's the big question. What everyone asks from any killer is why. So, after doing this entire thing, what is your conclusion on Tom Odell's conclusion on why, how he could do this? How, I mean, he had fights. He disagreed with his mother. He was going to be kicked out by his family. But why? How is he capable of doing this, and why?
Sure. And there's not a simple answer to that. This is clearly complex human behavior, and there are a multitude of factors that led to this crime and that lead to these types of crimes. And in my opinion, and I think I think Tom Odell agrees with me. From I think having learned what he has learned from engaging in this process and some of the insight that he has gained from engaging in this process, that I think there are there are a number of key factors. First of all, there are the factors that led to him being who he was at that point in his in his development in his life, and those factors, as I've already mentioned, the fact that he's got a his early personality development is formed with a life of physical and mental abuse, and that then influenced many of his choices as he as he continued to develop, and the acting out behaviors and the aggression and the violence and the drug abuse and so on, and then the failures and the growing depression. So in my view, there are all those factors that kind of, just formed who he is, or certainly who he was at that time. And then, but I think what really escalated it into to a homicidal level for him to want to kill was the fact that you know, this abusive mother whom he hated for many reasons, that his father, who when he was young, he had a relationship with his father, and he trusted his father, but his father was, you know, allowed the mother to do what she did. And I think, you know, unless you're really familiar with kind of the dynamics of child abuse in a household, particularly with boys, boys will often, in a situation where there is an abusive mother and there's a passive father who allows the abuse to go on, boys will often end up resenting the father as much, if not more, than they do the abusive mother, because, you know, he doesn't protect them, and he doesn't, you know, he's the father, he's dad, he's supposed to, you know, he's the same sex as me, we're guys, he should be taking care of me, and he didn't do that. And what he did actually is the opposite of that. He aligned with the abuser. He aligned with the abusive mother to basically abandon Tom. And I think that was something that he could not accept. He could not tolerate. I think that was the point where that was the point of no return. They were going to throw him out of the house. He had nowhere to go. He had no money. He had nothing. But he was going to be abandoned. And the father, who he had always kind of wanted to trust and wanted to love and wanted to align himself with, was now not on his side anymore. And that was it. So he was all alone. He was he was depressed. He was he was influenced by drugs, and it was this this revenge and hatred that just came pouring out of him in this kind of drug fueled nihilistic type of rage. Although quite strategic and methodical, it was still nonetheless an act of rage. And I think that to me is the explanation why the parents were murdered. That then, however, doesn't answer the question about why murder the siblings? Why murder these three innocent children? They didn't ever really do anything to him. But I think that's when, that's what happens with mass murders. And, after the trigger is pulled, or after, the knife is plunged, and after that first one or two killings, there's no coming back. It's you're over the bridge. And, then it becomes kind of an all or nothing type of phenomenon in the minds of someone who is actively homicidal. And that was the case for him, I believe, in that it was, it's now, I now just need to take out the entire family and terminate this whole, and terminate this family, because there's no coming back from this, and my life is over, and I'm going to kill myself tomorrow, so I'm just going to end it all. And it's very nihilistic. It's very devastating. It's the annihilation of a family unit, and that's how I perceive it. That's how I understand it, and I think that is, it's difficult to kind of appreciate and kind of understand the mentality that people like that have in that moment in time, but that does seem to be an explanation that makes uh, makes sense, and I can tell you that Tom Odell agrees with that.
It's a very interesting book. What I got to say, just maybe a little spoiler for the reader, is that Tom Odell doesn't really seem to come to terms with the whole thing, though. It seems that he says there was a voice in his head and a command, it said, he should do this and I need to do this, and it seemed like he was out of body. It wasn't quite him. It seems like a combination of things that I've heard before. And not to say he's being disingenuous, but it's just, again, while we look for the answers, he looks for the answers, we look for the answers, in the end there's not really any real concrete answers, except other than this is a kind of a background that created this confluence of events that created this tragic event, and that's about all you could say, that you've done a splendid job of really analyzing this as much as anyone possibly can. And it's very interesting, the articulate and introspective letters that Tom Odell writes and writes you, and become the backbone of this book as well. And so I commend you for both of you doing a great job in trying to understand this, at least looking at one particular case and saying this was the recipe for disaster that created, that surely was the factors in contributing to this very, very, very sad event, really.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate your comments and your feedback, and you're exactly right. I mean, there's no definitive or simple or concrete explanation for these kind. I think for any acts like this, they're far more complex than that, so you try to factor in the various components that as a psychologist that I can look at and try to add to the formula that makes sense, and that's what that's certainly what we tried to do here. And it would be very nice to pin it down to this is the reason why, but it's human behavior, and it's just not as simple as often we would like it to be.
Yes, absolutely. And I got to have so much sympathy for the killer, because I think we have an audience here that doesn't shed too many tears for killers, but is a really compassionate audience and very understanding of life experiences itself and what can happen, and being true crime readers and fans of true crime, they hear a lot of these very tragic stories, and again, we're always looking for answers. So this is
I'm glad you brought up that point, because I can tell you this is Tom Odell isn't looking for sympathy. And, he doesn't deserve sympathy. This is not what this is about. This is about, an individual who looks back on a life that is filled with mistakes and problems and bad decisions and, that had horrible effects on many, many people, and 5 people died. And, he knows perfectly well that, no one is going to sympathize with him despite whatever he endured. He knows that perfectly well, and he's not looking for that. His objective is pretty much the same as mine, and that was really why we did this book, is that, if sharing this story can possibly increase awareness for people to understand how these kinds of crimes may end up being committed, and help people maybe identify behaviors and tendencies that may end up resulting in extreme domestic violence. If that's what this, that's in any way, and not to be grandiose about it, but if that can, help anyone prevent crimes like this, then certainly I will be thrilled, and Tom Odell will be very pleased that, his story had some positive impact.
Well, I was going to say is that even though there's no sympathy for him, I do admire his candidacy in terms of being very candid, very truthful, and really, again, it doesn't seem to be any benefit. He's not going to get out of prison, and he's certainly not looking for fans by revealing as much as he did with this book. There is no fame from this, certainly, that killers seek out typically, so... again, I got to commend the guy for being as truthful, because this is really what we're always looking for is somebody to, in retrospect, try to look at this and try to explain basically something as horrible as this. For those that might be, I don't know if you're a person that uses Facebook or if there's a website, somebody might be able to contact you, or somebody might want a more personal copy of a book. So often there is that possibility. I know Amazon and Barnes & Noble and your local bookstore, but tell us if there is any way to contact you if anyone is considering contacting you for any reason.
Sure. There is a website for the book. It is survivedbyone.com, and it provides a lot more information about the story and also provides information about some of the points I was just talking about a moment ago about preventing domestic violence, particularly preventing domestic homicides, and so there's a lot more information there. That there are videotapes of interviews with me, and there are other articles and reviews and that type of information on the website. If someone is interested in contacting me directly, my email address is r-hanlon, H-A-N-L-O-N, at northwestern.edu.
Great. Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Hanlon, for number one, for the Survive by One, a great, great read, and thank you for this interview as well, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
And you have a good evening. Good night.
Okay, you too. Good night.